So nice to have you back, Colonel, on this podcast.
Thank you for inviting me again. Thank you.
Yeah. And let's get started with what's going on right now in the Middle East. We had the assassination of Nasrallah in Lebanon. And right now they're talking about, Israelis are talking about going underground, an offensive underground. And Hezbollah, the deputy secretary, secretary general, his name is, let me check it out here. His name is Naim Qassem. He said that we are ready to fight on the ground to fight Israel. How do you see the current face of the conflict? And what was the necessity of the assassination of Nasrallah in Lebanon?
Well, I think we have to understand the rationale behind this, let's say, constant attempt from Israel to escalate conflict. Since its creation, Israel has, in fact, never really used diplomatic ties to improve its situation in the Middle East. No, the Israeli diplomacy was mostly oriented towards a consolidation of the bound between the West, especially the United States, and Israel. But they never used diplomacy as a tool to stabilize their environment, their political and strategic environment. And probably this is something, I'm going a little bit back into history, because we just started the discussion just before the going live today, but I think it's important for people to understand that. My country, Switzerland, has always felt a lot of similarities with Israel, being a very tiny country in the middle of several powers, big powers, Italy, Germany, France, which today are friendly, but they used to be enemy two centuries ago. And Israel is in a very similar situation, in an environment where they consider their neighbors as enemy. But interestingly enough, Switzerland considered very soon, and namely already at the from the mid 19th century, that its security depended on the good relations with the neighbors and with a stable environment of their neighbors, meaning that Switzerland tried to promote stability not just in its country but also in its neighborhood, if you want. And that has been up to these days. That has been a fundamental aspect of Swiss foreign policy and Swiss diplomacy. Now, in Israel, the situation is a little bit different because, as we have seen since its creation, Israel has promoted kind of an aggressive stance towards the enemy. And in fact, they have as a strategy or a strategic tenet, if you want, that they need to be feared. They need to be stronger or to show more strength, more aggressiveness as their neighbors in order to achieve security. And that's, here we can see the difference. In Switzerland, we consider that relationship with countries is based on diplomacy, on politics. In Israel, when they came and arrived in just after World War II in the area, they considered that their enemies or their neighbors were enemies because of a factor that you cannot change, which is religion. They convinced themselves that because they are Jews, they will never be at peace with their neighbors. And therefore, it was pointless to look at a peaceful relationship. You just have to show that you are stronger than your neighbors, and therefore you will have security. So stability is achieved through force, while in Switzerland, its stability is achieved through good services and active diplomacy. And in Israel, since this the neighbors, namely mainly Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, and mainly I would say Syria and Egypt, these are very big countries with a very strong potential. And therefore, the policy of Israel has been to promote the division in these countries. And that's one of the explanation for the attempt of the West, because at the end of the day, it is both Israel and Western countries who tried to destabilize Syria. And that was the case on many occasions in Egypt. I have mentioned on your channel several times the famous Levon affair in the 50s, where it was a deliberate policy by the Israeli intelligence service, the Aman, the military intelligence service, to create chaos in Egypt through terrorism in order to require, if you want, the Western intervention. So this is the point, the Israeli point of view of international of their international neighborhood and security is based on chaos. You create chaos in order to have to weaken your enemies and to, let's say, require intervention from friendly countries from the West. That's the whole issue. And that's exactly what we have seen unfold. That's why Israel needs Iran as their best enemy, if you want. You know, Iran, historically, Iran and Israel had always very good relations, especially during the Shah time. And Iran and Israel have no territorial problems. I mean, there is no territorial claims from either party. Basically, they are in different areas. I mean, in French, we make the distinction between Near East and Middle East, and Iran is a power of the Middle East, while Israel is in the Near East. So it's a different type of neighborhood. It's a different type of constellation. It's a different type. I mean, Iran is a competitor to Saudi Arabia for on many points, in particular for the oil trade and all that. Probably on the religious scene as well. Although this has been, in fact, probably it's overplayed in the West and probably not as important. In or less important as Westerners think, the religious dimension. But anyway, it's a different area. The Levant, so this area of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, up to the Nile River, in fact, which is the so-called Levant, is an area for itself. It has been today, it's several countries, but it was in fact split after World War I, as the Ottoman Empire was dismantled. But in essence, this is a strong area in itself. And in order to impose itself in this area, Israel had to find an enemy. But so far, and especially thanks to the U.S. diplomacy, because that's in fact the work not of the Israeli diplomacy, but of the U.S. diplomacy. Most countries of the area are at peace with Israel. So Israel had to find an enemy that justifies its kind of aggressive stance. And Iran was the ideal one because since 1979, it is an official enemy of the United States after the revolution, the Islamic revolution. And for some reason, Israel decided that's their enemy too. But there is no real reason for that. In fact, what happened is that after the various interventions of the US, and namely in Iraq, in the West has increased the weight of the Shia influence in the region, because, as you remember, Saddam Hussein was, in fact, he was non-religious, essentially, because its Ba'ath regime was essentially based on some kind of socialist ideology, and basically was above religion. And religion was not a fundamental aspect of the regime. But when the US toppled Saddam Hussein, then the very strong Shiite minority, it's probably even a majority, I don't know exactly today, but let's say a very strong minority, regained power and established, in fact, some kind of land bridge between Iran, Syria, and Lebanon, and therefore reinforcing this kind of Shiite belt around Saudi Arabia, which raised, by the way, concerns and helped these so-called spring revolutions and the Arab Springs and things like that in the year 2010, 2011, 2012. So we have here Israel that creates an artificial enemy in order to have the support of the West, because otherwise, without Iran, the West would not be very keen to get into this region. So we are in this situation today. And in addition to that, there is a point that is very important and probably underestimated in the West, is that Israel has never defined its borders. Meaning that since the very beginning, and that was a decision taken the day before the Declaration of Independence of Israel in May 1948, it was a deliberate decision not to define the border. The current border of Israel is, in fact, a ceasefire line. It's a ceasefire line. It's not a border. And that's the reason why Israel doesn't feel bound by this border and tries to get into these neighbors' territory. That's exactly what we have in Lebanon, by the way, where Israel still occupies very tiny portions of the Lebanese territory, but it's still an occupied power. That's also for the same reason Israel feels entitled to occupy Golan Heights and the so-called Palestinian territories, the Palestinian occupied territories, which are, as you have seen in the last couple of weeks, we had this decision of the UN General Assembly to support the decision of the International Court of Justice that has declared that the presence of Israel in the occupied territory is illegal. But Israel doesn't give a damn about these decisions because it feels totally, let's say, entitled to occupy these territories. And that's interesting because very recently, and namely after we had these cases, and probably it's interesting, that was in the Jerusalem Post, that the question is raised in Israel whether Israel considers even Lebanon as part of the so-called Greater Israel. As part of the promised land, if you want. Because Israel, the reason why Israel has never defined its borders, it's because there is still in the air this idea of a greater Israel that would extend from the Nile River to the Mesopotamian River. The name of the river is going out of my mind in a moment, but this is still this idea. And remember that Benjamin Netanyahu, his party, the Likud, comes from a party that was created in the late 30s, 1930s. This is called the Zionist Revisionist Movement. And the word revisionist comes from this idea that the British should revise their decision of giving Transjordan to the Jordanians. This is today's Jordan. If you look, I have here a small leaflet, and probably, well, you can see that. It's a leaflet from this party that was printed in the early 40s or so. And you see the map here. And this map is Israel, the current Israel, from the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, to the Jordan, plus here Jordan. And that's that remains the symbol of this movement that ended up to be the current Likud, that at the end wants to recover Jordan as part of Israel. So we have here an ideology, we can say it that way. It's more an ideology than a strategy, ideology that wants to have a kind of a hegemony on a region. And that explains the absence of definition of the border, and that explains partly the aggressive stance of Israel against its neighbors. And that's exactly what we are witnessing today. When we question ourselves, why does Israel seem to escalate the tensions? It's because the security of Israel is not based on peace, it's based on aggressiveness. And the more aggressive is the one that will last the most or the longest. And that's exactly the point. And that's exactly what we are witnessing today. And the logic, when we see what's going on, I mean, that was in Gaza and the failure in Gaza, the failure in the West Bank, and to some extent, the failure in addressing the problem with Lebanon. This failure seems to just promote a more aggressive posture of Israel, because it's a concept of security that is based not on peace, but on war. And that's a very strange and let's say unusual understanding of security, especially today, especially for a European, because Europeans have obviously a bad experience with two world wars, and the lesson that we got from World War II was that we should try to live in peace, and precisely instead of having rivalries and competition between ourselves, we should work together. That was the idea. That was very much the result of World War II. But this kind of thinking has apparently not reached Israel. Although we see, when we see the attacks on Israel, on almost every occasion they try to provoke a reaction, we see, especially from Iran, for instance, that's part of the tensions that are rising today between Iran and Hezbollah, because the Hezbollah considers Iran as its main, let's say, ally in the region, I could say, and Iran on its part doesn't want to engage into regional war. And we have seen, you remember that in April this year, as Iran wanted to respond to the provocation of the destruction of the Iranian consulate in Damascus, the Iranian wait for 2 weeks before reacting. And in fact, it was not a wait. During that time, the Iranians made contacts with the US and with other partners through intermediaries, and namely, I think it's Oman, who was used as intermediary. And Iran wanted to, in fact, to make sure that what its response would not trigger a regional conflict. And for that, they make sure about two things. The first, they made sure that the US understands that the Iranian reaction or response would be limited and was not designed at opening a war with Israel. So they said, we have to react. That will be a tough reaction, but it will be measured. It will be limited to military objectives and with no intent to escalate the conflict. So they wanted US to make sure of that. And on the other hand, Iran wanted to make sure that the US would not intervene as a result of this response. These are the two points that the Iranian diplomacy tried to make sure before the response. And now we had this assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. And Iran said they will respond, but they wanted to respond at the right time and with the right, let's say, with the right response. The problem is that with the escalating tensions in the region, the window of opportunity is becoming smaller and smaller for Iran, meaning that they don't want to escalate the conflict. That's absolutely clear from the Iranian side. They don't want to provoke the involvement of other countries or nations, Western nations or so. But at the same time, they have to make sure that their own territorial sovereignty is respected. So it's a very, very delicate, let's say, response that they have to provide at the right time, at the right place, and with the right tools. And the assassination of Nasrallah, in fact, tends to make this kind of thinking in Iran to make it upside down. Because with that, it removes the opportunity the opportunity of Iran to think about the right time. You know, Iran, they didn't want to be pushed into a reaction. They wanted to react, but again, at its own pace. And this, and that's probably also the reason why Israel did that assassination, because in fact, this assassination will change absolutely nothing on the ground. It will not affect significantly the abilities and capabilities of Hezbollah. And it comes after this, what we can, from a very technical point of view, we can call that a terrorist attack with those beepers and talkie-walkies, because it was indiscriminate. It affected both civilians and probably military. And that was totally disproportionate in size. That came out of the blue with no reason, with no operational objective. As a result, it can be defined as a terrorist attack. So we see that Israel is multiplying the provocations, and Hezbollah feels obliged to respond. And at one point, it will request Iran to respond. But I think Iran doesn't want to respond as long as there is no, let's say, existential threat for the population in South Lebanon. Let's put it that way. So they are waiting for the right moment to intervene. That's my personal view. And that's the reason why Israel is just raising the tension. But it's interesting to see that since the It's also, I just wanted to show here that in the reaction of when we see what happened, because we talk about Gaza, we know that Hezbollah has made some attacks in northern Israel. But now if we check at the figures, and that come from Al Jazeera, we see that since October 7th, the Israeli have launched something like 8,000 attacks in Lebanon, and Hezbollah has attacked almost 1,800 attacks against military objectives. And you see that because, in fact, the number of civilian casualties is minimal. And from these 32 Israeli victims, you have about 20 that are the result of failing Israeli missiles like Iron Dome and things like this. So the number of victims that Hezbollah has created in Israel is absolutely minimal. While on the other hand, these Lebanese had about 700 probably today, 700 and probably less, more than that, this, because you had the attacks against Hassan Nasrallah and other attacks in the recent days. So we are probably around 900 deaths in Lebanon. But we see that the Israelis target civilians, while the Hezbollah targets military objectives. And that shows again that the Hezbollah just needs to make sure that its sovereignty, if I can put it that way, is respected and doesn't want to escalate the conflict. But if Israel intervene in South Lebanon, that might prompt for stronger reaction from Iran. And that's probably what Israel is aiming at, in fact. So they take somehow South Lebanon as a hostage to provoke an Iranian response against Israel. That's probably how we can explain everything which is playing out now in this region.
And the question right now would be, do they really need Hezbollah? Does Hezbollah need Iran on their part if Israel goes underground? What do we know about their capabilities on the ground?
Well, in fact, Hezbollah is considered by many as one of the most powerful armies in the Near East. And it's interesting to see that I don't have the figures exactly in terms of number of combatants and all that. But we know that already in 2006, Hezbollah managed to, resist to the Israeli aggression very successfully. And that in the meantime, especially during the Syrian uprising, and especially as the Islamic State started to come close to Damascus, the Hezbollah deployed some troops with the agreement of the Syrian government. So they deployed some troops in order to fight against the Islamic State. And the reason why was that the Hezbollah feared that the Islamic State could attack also South Lebanon, and they used somehow Syria as a kind of buffer zone. And if you remember at that time, Hezbollah forces got the permission from the Syrian government to deploy troops around Lebanon on Syrian territory in order to preempt any possible attack from the Islamic State and other Sunni militias. Because when we say Islamic State, in fact, we're a little bit playing with words when we talk about the Syrian uprising in Syria. In the West, we tend to see these the militias are as simply opposition against Bashar al-Assad. But in fact, it's a little bit more than opposition. It was definitely Sunni extremists. And we could see, especially after 2016, 2017, as Western forces, and namely the US, France, Netherlands, Belgium, among others, started to bomb the Islamic State. A lot of combatants of the Islamic State just changed they went into other movements, because the Western forces targeted the Islamic State but didn't target other movements such as the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and these movements who were exactly the same, by the way. They had exactly the same ideology, but the Westerners tried to avoid these groups because, in fact, the West was supporting the opposition to Bashar al-Assad. As a result, these extremist groups, other than the Islamic State, were in fact supported by the Westerners. And therefore, a lot of combatants from the Islamic State just changed group. But they were the same people, the same fighter, the same ideology, but just with another name. And for that reason, that's exactly what the Hezbollah identified. And for that reason, they create this kind of buffer zone on Syrian territory. But with that, the Hezbollah became a very battle-hardened army, if you want, because it's probably, we cannot just say it's a movement. It's not even a clandestine movement. That's why when we call them terrorist group in the West, that's a little bit a distortion, and that doesn't facilitate our understanding of what Hezbollah is. Because if you look at how Hezbollah behave in Lebanon, it's not a clandestine organization. It appears openly. It has defilés where you have those troops marching and in the open with uniform weaponry, with dedicated units, artillery, drones, infantry, and things like that. And when you have a defile in Lebanon, in South Lebanon, they have their face open. They don't hide their face. So it's not a clandestine organization. It's a militia very similar to what we have in Switzerland, for instance, where you have a popular army. In fact, it's more or less like this. And or Israel. Israel is also an army which takes its combatant from the population. And it's very similar with the Hezbollah. And that's why, and by the way, Hezbollah, as we know, Hezbollah is a party of God. It's a political party with deputies in the parliament and all that. They have, as I explained last time, they have open activities, especially in the welfare area, in social welfare and things like this. So it's not a clandestine organization. And what we know from them, it's a defensive organization, which is based on a network on concrete bunkers and things like this. So it's a defensive organization, basically. It's not equipped and not, let's say, organized for invading Israel, for instance. And it has no territorial claim on Israeli territory. The only territorial claims are on Lebanese territory. So they defend their territory. They are not they don't want to claim the territory of Palestine, for instance. And that's a big difference with Palestinian movements such as the Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the Fatah, and all that, who claim authority on the whole territory of Palestine. So that's the Palestinian side. They have nothing like this with the Hezbollah. That's why when you see Israel claiming that Hezbollah is a threat for its existence, it's an artificial threat again that was created by Israel, because Hezbollah has absolutely no claim over Israeli territory. So what we have, claim of Israel is just based on the fact that Israel has invaded Lebanon, continues permanently to violate Lebanese airspace, to bomb Lebanon very frequently. And again, you have to refer to the regular reports of the intervention force, the United Nations force in Lebanon, UNIFIL, that provide every 6 months a report on the situation that explains perfectly all these violations from Israel. So we see that Israel has an eye on the Lebanese territory, but it's not the opposite is not true. So we have here again a situation where Israel creates enemies rather than solve problems with their neighbors. So it's a strategy of antagonizing their neighbors instead of finding solutions with their neighbors. This is a very peculiar situation. You have that, I think, in no other part of the world, that a country just seeks to create insecurity and sees the chaos as a key for its own security. That's very peculiar. So that's a little bit what explains the situation. So Hezbollah is a very strong army, and if Israel would attack, I'm confident that the Israelis will do a lot of destruction and bring a lot of death on Lebanese territory. But at the same time, you will have exactly something very similar to what we have seen in Gaza, that at the end, they will have to withdraw, they will be unsuccessful, they will have a lot of casualties, a lot of destroyed equipment, and they will just create more hate against themselves. That's the situation of the Israelis. But I'm confident, despite all the destruction and the death, they will not be able to take over the southern part of Lebanon. The idea, I think, which is floating now in Israel, is that Israel could create kind of a buffer zone between the current so-called border of Israel and the Litani River. And that would be that's more or less the place where you have the UNIFIL, by the way, so the UN forces, it's deployed in this area. So meaning that the gain of Israel would be minimal. I'm not sure they will achieve that. I'm not sure they could be able to ensure that, even if they realize this buffer zone, I'm not sure they will be able to maintain that buffer zone, because it's just repelling your enemy 20 or 25 kilometers is one thing, but then how can you get a hold on that territory in the longer term? And I'm not sure that Israel is able to do that. We have seen that Israel has not been able to do that in Gaza. There were, I think, no places that they have occupied in Gaza is still under the control of Israel. And Gaza is a much smaller place than southern Lebanon. So I'm not sure the Israel can achieve that. As a result, I think if there is intervention, ground intervention in from Israel. This will again probably cost a lot of lives in South Lebanon, but at the end of the day, the Israeli will not be able to keep that territory. That's my personal view.
And the question right now would be with these assassinations, not Nasrallah, but many commanders in Lebanon, do you think the new commanders that are coming to the command system of Hezbollah, do you find it that they're getting more aggressive toward Israel? Or because these people are younger people who have been in Syria, in Iraq, they have on the battlefield firsthand experience of what would be a underground conflict directly with the enemy. How do you see the impact they're bringing to the command system of Hezbollah?
Well, that's interesting. It's an interesting question because in my book on the Al-Aqsa flood, I tried to make a summary of some of the killings that Israel has done against Palestinians and all that. And we have seen that each time Israel has killed a senior leader of a Palestinian movement, this guy was replaced by a more radical and a stronger chief. Meaning that basically Israel has never gained anything from killing a senior commander. The line of command, I mean, the control, the command and control system of groups, especially in Palestine, but it applies also to the Hezbollah, because Hezbollah, although being an open type of militia, if you want, they understand that they are under permanent threat of Israel, and therefore the structure of the force is based on a very decentralized command. So you have, if you want, a general orientation given by the senior leadership, and then at ground level, up to battalion, I would say, you have a lot of autonomy in addressing the situation. So these battalion on the ground do not depend on orders coming from above, meaning that even if Israel destroys the senior management, that will probably not affect the combativeness of the ground forces, the forces on the ground. That's one thing, and that's exactly the same, by the way, in Palestine, including in Gaza. You may remember that since the 7th of October, we had regular reports from Israel that they killed the head of that Katiba and of this Katiba and so on and so forth. But when we look at the operational effectiveness of these Katiba, we see absolutely no change, meaning that killing the boss doesn't change anything on the ground, because he's very quickly replaced by someone who has equally great experience. By the way, in the military, generally speaking, when you look at the structure of a unit, a military unit, generally speaking, it can be in Western armies or in any army, you always have a deputy commander. The deputy commander is precisely the guy who takes over when the commander is killed, meaning that basically he knows exactly what's the plan, he knows exactly what are the units, he knows how everything works. So basically it's a kind of a regular business in a military unit. When the commander is killed, he's automatically replaced by another. And you have that at every level, meaning that in essence, during the combat, you can probably, I mean, there might be changes. It might be that you have less capable commander. That may happen. But by and large, I would say that killing the commanders is more for propaganda and PR purposes than for effectiveness on the ground. Because in reality, if your deputy are well trained, well prepared, then you will feel no change in the overall effectiveness of your combat unit. As a result, I don't expect to have significant changes. In addition to that, as I explained, it, it's very true for Palestinians. It's probably less true, but it's very similar in the Hezbollah, that they have a modular structure. That means that each unit, combat unit, can fight in independently from the rest of a bigger unit. They don't need to have upper command. They can fight autonomously. And that's exactly what you have seen in Gaza. The Israelis tend to look at the Palestinians as if it were a conventional army. But in reality, you have a lot of different independent cells that are able to act independently from the others with a lot of autonomy in terms of decision-making based on the tactical situation. And that's exactly what you have in the Hezbollah. And again, that's where the battle experience is very important. The battle experience is not simply about how you use your assault rifle or your anti-tank weapon and things like this. This helps, but it's not the essence. When we say battle hardened or the battle experience, is how you manage the command and control under in combat situation. That's the key aspect. Command and control is the central element that makes you effective or ineffective at war. And that's exactly what the Lebanese, and namely the Hezbollah, has as a let's say advantage when we compare with the Israelis. The Israelis, now they have a couple of divisions and at least three new brigades that have been created. But a lot of the people in these units are reserve units, meaning that these guys have not really battle experience. They have been drafted from the civilian society. As a result, they might not be as proficient when it comes to decision making on the battlefield, in battle condition, and things like this. So my view is that certainly Israel will, as we know, they will be able to strike indiscriminately and disproportionately against a civilian population. They will take the whole population as enemy. That's, they have always done that. By the way, what we have seen, especially as it comes to the killing of Hassan Nasrallah, for instance, they apply what is called the Dahiya doctrine. Dahiya is a suburb of Beirut. By the way, that's where Hassan Nasrallah was killed, by the way. But the Dahiya doctrine is a doctrine that was established in the late 1980s. Probably it was officially announced in 2008, I think. It has been probably elaborated before, but it was officially announced in 2008. And this doctrine is about the undisproportionate use of force, meaning that the idea is to scare your enemy by using force in an indisproportionate manner. And that's exactly what we have seen when you kill Hassan Nasrallah with a carpet bombing and using a 2,000 pounds bomb, the Mark 84, which came from the US, by the way. When you use this kind of weapon, that means that basically you don't care about civilian casualties. And you, by killing the senior leader, you try to scare the population. That's exactly what the Israeli will do, and they will certainly leave a lot of fatalities on the ground. That's for sure. But I'm not sure they will have victory as such. We have to remember that for Muslim, generally speaking, the word jihad is not about war. It's about resistance, the ability to resist. And victory for a Muslim, generally speaking, but that applies in particular because that was mentioned in 2006, by the way. The thing is that the victory is not associated with the destruction of the enemy, but is associated with the capacity of resisting, meaning that if you don't give up, you are victorious. So victory is about not giving up. It's not about destroying the enemy. As a result, regardless of what Israel does in South Lebanon, I can already predict that the Hezbollah will be victorious because they will not give up. We can assume that they will not give up, and therefore they will have a victory. And the number of casualties that Israel will suffer, that will probably be disproportionate in comparison to what the Lebanese will suffer. But this will have more impact on the Israeli population than the death in Lebanon. A guy who dies in Lebanon by defending its country, he's a martyr. He's a martyr. So basically, this guy will gain something by dying, if you want, which is counterintuitive if we consider that from a Western perspective. But that's, remember that in this conflict in the Near East, we have a confrontation between a Western mindset, and namely the Israelis, and an Oriental or Middle East mindset. And that's the reason why I think that at the end of the day, we are in what I define as asymmetry. This is the mindset that makes this difference. And the regardless of what will happen on the ground, the Hezbollah will be victorious. And in addition to the Hezbollah, there is something I haven't mentioned so far, but I think it has to be taken into consideration, is the number of units that might join the Hezbollah in fighting Israel. And you have already a certain number of Iraqi Shiite groups that have declared their readiness to join Hezbollah in case of Israeli invasion. Meaning that when we talk about Hezbollah, we talk about the Hezbollah we know, but we probably should take into consideration other regional actors that might join Hezbollah in fighting Israel. And remember that those groups are probably not insignificant. I have mentioned a couple of times on your channel, I think, although it was not really reflected in Western media, that these Iraqi groups already made some attacks since the 7th of October on oil depots in Haifa also with cruise missiles. So meaning that those groups are not just groups with Kalashnikov and things like this. They are probably much more elaborate and have probably more capabilities than what we could expect from such group that we consider as loose militias and things like this, that we tend to qualify as terrorists and things like this. The word terrorists is a very misguided term for many of these groups because it tends to lead us to underestimate their value and their capabilities on the ground. Remember that these so-called terrorists are those who, at the end of the day, could repel the Americans. I mean, the Americans have lost Iraq. They have destroyed the Saddam Hussein regime. That's one thing. But they never managed to get full control over Iraq. So these guys are not insignificant in terms of capabilities. And I think we should take them into consideration when we talk about Hezbollah, about the possible Israeli intervention in South Lebanon. So, meaning that I don't know what is in the mind of the Israeli militaries. I know that the Israeli military is very hesitant to engage into Lebanon. This is probably more the political leadership that is willing to do so rather than the military leadership. But at the end of the day, if Netanyahu decides so, he will do so. And I think if we look at the whole picture, again, I'm sure that the Israeli will be extremely, the Israeli intervention can be very painful for Lebanon. But at the same time, I'm convinced, and I can, with a very high level of certainty, say that they will not be victorious in this operation. That will take a lot of lives in Lebanese lives, that's for sure, probably much more than Israeli lives, but at the end, that will lose and not the Lebanese. That's my personal understanding of what, based on experience, based on what we have seen in the past in Syria against Sunni forces, and in 2006 against Israeli forces. So that's more or less my assessment.
Yeah, because right now, beside this conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, we have Israelis attacking Houthis in Yemen together with the United States. And on the other hand, we had a joint Syria-Russia and together a bombing of fighter jets bombing the Idlib of this part of Syria, that they're thinking that they're terrorists and they're doing something against Bashar al-Assad. How do you put these together? Or is Russia there too? Because they're feeling that something going on in Syria, that's why they're doing this, or it's a bigger picture of the conflict in the Middle East?
Well, first of all, there are different things that we have to to understand that somehow is not reflected in our media. First of all, when we talk about actions in the Idlib pocket by Syrian forces and Syrian and Russian forces, we have to remember that recently the Ukrainian special forces were sent to Idlib precisely to train those extremists I can show you this picture. So you have actually Ukraine trying to engage the Russians in Syria. And not just in Syria, but also in other places. I mean, you see, that was reflected in the Kyiv Post. It's not just simply a Kremlin propaganda. That was stated in the Ukrainian media, that you have Ukrainian special forces attacking Russians in Syria. And it's not just that, you have that in Sudan as well, Ukrainian attacking Russians in Sudan and in Mali. So meaning that you have, sorry about that. you have the Ukrainians, in fact, exporting the conflict, the Ukrainian conflict, to the Middle East in order to fight Russia. And that helps Russia to consolidate its action with Syria against the Idlib. Remember also that I haven't mentioned that today, but you have a lot of units or combatants, better said, that were recruited by Ukraine in the Idlib region and sent to Ukraine in order to compensate for the lack of personnel on the battlefront in Ukraine. So by doing so, Ukraine, in fact, is simply pressing Russia to fight Ukrainians and allies of Ukraine in the Middle East, in Idlib and elsewhere. Now, about the Houthis, it's not new. And you may remember that earlier this year, the Israelis and the U.S. tried to make a raid with special forces in Yemen. I don't know for which purpose. The fact of the matter is that this raid was completely destroyed by the Houthis. All these special forces were decimated on the ground, both Americans and Israelis. So it's not new that Israel tries to fight the Houthis. And the Americans tried to do the same. And I remind you that that was end of last year. Joe Biden said in an interview that the U.S. will not be able to stop the Houthis supporting the Palestinians. So the Houthis are extremely skilled fighters. Remember that they are fighting in Yemen since decades. So they are extremely battle-hardened. They have a very strong determination. And I think we have... This can be demonstrated by the fact that they were not afraid to attack even Navy ships, British Navy and U.S. Navy ships in the Red Sea. So these guys are absolutely determined to support the idea of a ceasefire, because I remind you that the Houthis, they decided to put an embargo on Israel in the Red Sea. And in fact, all these missiles are essentially enforcing this embargo until Israel accepts a permanent ceasefire. That's the objective. And as long as Israel refuses to sign or to participate to a ceasefire, then the Houthis will fight. But it's very interesting to see that despite all the sanctions, despite the bombing from the US, from the British, from the French, despite all this, and despite the presence of military Navy ships in the Red Sea, they were not discouraged and they continued to support. In fact, to some extent, I would say they are the most determined to support the Palestinians among the whole Arabic world. I mean, with the exception of, I mean, Arabic world, because Iran is not Arabic, formally speaking. But we can see that the, and probably Lebanon, because Lebanon, they are Arabic. But this is interesting to see this contrast between the behavior of the Houthis and the behavior of other countries such as Egypt, Jordan. Syria is a special case because they have their own problems, domestic problems. But we can see that most Arab countries are quite reluctant to take, let's say, concrete steps in support of the Palestinians. The Houthis have no hesitation. And in that sense, they are, in my view, courageous people. And we can probably discuss the method. We can argue on that, but we also have to acknowledge that when they shoot their missiles, they don't try to kill indiscriminately civilians, for instance. So the behavior we see from the Israelis is not replicated by the other region, including the Houthis. They are able to strike in the heart of Israel, but they avoid to make civilian casualties. So we can see that this behavior, although Israel said that it's impossible to avoid civilian casualties, apparently the Arabs are more successful in avoiding civilian casualties than the Israelis. But in my view, we are playing with words, because I think the Israelis never, I underline twice, never tried to spare civilian Palestinian or Arab lives. Never. They don't care about lives that are outside their borders or with the Palestinians. So that's absolutely clear. But the others care more, and they are able to adjust the use of their weapons in such a way that they can avoid civilian casualties. So we are here in a situation, I think, that again underscores the inability for Israel to abide by the international humanitarian law. Again, the three basic rules of IHL, international humanitarian law, law of war, if you prefer, this is the principle of distinction, to be able to distinguish between civilian and military targets, the principle of proportionality, that means that your action must be proportionate with the objective you want to achieve. So you don't destroy a whole population just for the sake of killing one person. And finally, the principle of precaution. That means that when in doubt, you just abstain to use your weapons. Those three principles, which are at the very base of international humanitarian law, have never been respected by Israel. In no occasion. And we know why, because they said it, and the current leadership has repeatedly explained why it is so. It's because they consider the others as human animals. That's exactly what was said by Yoav Gallant, if I'm not wrong. So that's the rationale, and that's, for me, the reason why I cannot understand the behavior of the international community, especially from the Western community, that claims fighting for values, that claims defending universal values of the UN and things like that, and at the same time, they tolerate, if not encourage, this behavior from Israel. I don't understand that. And that applies to my country, Switzerland, by the way.
Yeah. And Colin, shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, yesterday Joe Biden tweeted that Ukraine will win and we're going to support Ukraine. And when you look at the Zelensky's visit to the United States, in your opinion, what was the outcome of this visit? And is Ukraine gaining anything that would be substantial in terms of what they're doing in the conflict, in the war?
Well, Ukraine came back from, Zelensky came back from the US with some money, or let's say some promise of having some money. But that was expected. But I think more importantly, they didn't receive what they expected most. I mean, the authorization to use weapons in the depth of Russian territory, the immediate membership into NATO, immediate membership in the EU, and that were the key aspects of this visit, of this plan for victory that Zelensky wanted to present to Western leaders in New York. So he didn't get that. And I would even say that he got the opposite, because his plan for victory was not considered as, let's say, was not considered as realistic. And you may just look at the reaction of the Czech president, who just said that this plan should be more realistic, because, you know, Ukraine, although the Western countries said Ukraine has the right to enter NATO and we will do everything possible to make Ukraine part of NATO and blah, 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 blah. In reality, and I remind you that in March 2022, Zelensky told CNN that he asked the Americans whether he could be part of NATO, and he was told that no, he will not be part of NATO, but officially the door will remain open. That's the thing, because as the Ukraine is at war with Russia, there is no way it will be part, it will enter NATO when it is at war with Russia, because that would be then the use of the so-called, the famous Article 5 that asks every member of the alliance to help Ukraine. In normal times, when you're at peace, you have this assistance from other allies, but this is always a speculation. I mean, it's in case of war, it's a risk. But here, the risk is 100%, because Ukraine is already at war, meaning that if Ukraine enters NATO, that means that by the same token, every single member of NATO acknowledge that it might be called to assist Ukraine on the ground. And since NATO is a nuclear power, then it means that at one point you will have, or you might have, the risk of nuclear confrontation. I remind you that what Jan Stoltenberg said in April last year, I mean, he has repeated many times, he used to be my boss when I was in NATO, NATO will remain a nuclear alliance. This is the essence of NATO, is the nuclear capability of the US under which the European countries are. That's the essence of NATO, meaning that if you have a confrontation in Europe, it might end up to a nuclear confrontation. And that's the reason why they don't want to have this. And that's the reason why you have all these bilateral agreements that have been signed. Here you have these yellow countries that have signed agreement with Ukraine here in white. There are probably more. I'm not sure that this map is up to date, but in any case, it shows that because NATO is too powerful, they had to create those bilateral agreements. And that's, by the way, that shows that NATO is not the adequate response or the adequate tool for such crisis as the Ukrainian one. So we have this situation that Ukraine will not be member of NATO in the foreseeable future. I remind you that even Olaf Scholz said He said that it's that Ukraine will probably not be member of NATO within the next 30 years. So, in fact, coming back to from the US, I'm not sure Zelensky got anything. His plan was more or less rejected by Western countries. He got a little bit more money, okay, but that's in fact was expected, and that's not much. We know that that will not be sufficient to sustain a full-fledged war against Russia for a long time. So we know that. So he didn't get much. In fact, probably his visit in the U.S. demonstrated to Western countries that Ukraine, and especially the leadership of Ukraine, is delusional. Is delusional. And when we say, when Joe Biden say that Ukraine must prevail and it will prevail, what means prevail? Again, we are back to what we have mentioned a couple of times on your channel, when Lloyd Austin was audited by the Senate Committee for Armed Forces in the US, and a senator asked him, how do you find victory for Ukraine? And he was not able to articulate a definition of what could be victory for Ukraine, because we don't know what it means. You know, probably at one point we could say, okay, victory means that you push the Russian back to the borders, and that's a victory. You could probably, since we have said that Ukraine was so strong, probably Ukraine managed to go to Moscow, and entering Moscow would be probably a victory. But the reality is that despite the narrative and all that, it has never been the case. Ukraine has never been in a position even to push back the Russians in to the borders, and it will certainly not be able to enter Russia and reach Moscow in any situation. So what means a victory in that case? And what we see on the map shows that Russia has the freedom to define what it wants to call victory. It can define that on different ways, but it has the freedom to choose how you want to define victory. But from a Ukrainian point of view, how can you define victory? Because even Ukraine, how can you, Kursk, for instance, this incursion into Kursk, how can you define that as a victory? I mean, since early August, this pocket, the Ukrainian pocket in the Kursk Oblast, is shrinking every day. I think my view is that the Russians are not in a hurry to destroy the forces in Kursk, because strategically, this very tiny portion of territory is more important to the Ukrainians than it is to the Russians. As a result, Ukrainians tend to send a lot of troops to keep that small bit of territory, and therefore they are depleting the rest of the front line. And for that reason, the Russian may have, let's say, they find a benefit of keeping this pocket alive, if I can put it that way. They reduce it very slowly, because at the end of the day, they want to recover their territory, but they are not in a hurry to do that very fast. It's a very sparsely populated area, so there is absolutely no rush to regain this territory, and the Ukrainians are losing a lot of people. I mean, as of today, the Ukrainians have probably lost something like 17,000 men in this pocket, meaning that's almost twice the number of combatants they put into this pocket on the 6th of August this year. So the twice the potential that was sent in the initial attack was destroyed.
In the Kursk region, you're talking about?
In the Kursk region, yes. I'm talking about the Kursk region. That the initial attack, the very initial attack, was probably 1,000, 2,000 men. But very quickly, the Ukrainian brought additional troops, and that reached something like between 8 and 11,000 men, according to the figures we had, which I'm not sure which one is the most reliable. But let's say roughly 10,000 people they pour in the very first week of the attack. And today, when we count the number of casualties, so that means dead and wounded, we have something like 17,000. So it's about twice the number they had in the first week. And they keep bringing troops in that, because for them, having a piece of Russian territory is extremely important, because they figured out that this could be used in some kind of negotiation, you know? And that's the reason why for the Ukrainians it's more important. It had strategic importance, while for the Russians, it has more like tactical importance. So as a result, there is no time constraint for the Russians, while there is some constraint on the Ukrainian side. As a result, we have an army that is slightly disintegrating, and we see that every day with desertion, troops that refuse to fight, and so on and so forth. You have the opposition within Ukraine itself. I'm talking about the western part of Ukraine, because you have these, I don't know if I have here a picture, but you have the resistance in the western part of Ukraine, which is quite important. And I'm trying to find if I have it here, but probably not, unfortunately. No, I don't have it here. In any case, so you have a resistance movement resistance groups operating in the western part of Ukraine. You have people resisting forced recruitment and all that. So meaning that the mood in Ukraine itself is very much in favor of stopping hostilities. And you have more and more articles in the Kyiv Independent, the Kyiv Post, and so on, that question the rationale behind the position of the Ukrainian leadership. And this is the reason why we don't see a mood ready for victory in Ukraine. I mean, I think the population, including the media, by the way, have realized that what you call victory is something that cannot be defined very precisely. So when the West use that word prevailing or victory, what are they referring to? I mean, this is something which nobody can really understand, because on the ground is very hard to identify what could look like a victory. You have daily reports on villages and towns that are, the Russians call liberated. I don't know if it's the right word, but that's the word the Russians use in any case. But in any case, you see those towns and villages falling into the hands of Russians every day. How can you find a trace, the slightest trace of victory into that? There is none. And 2 years ago, all the small successes, the Russian successes didn't come into the Ukrainian media. I mean, Ukrainian media were just plain propaganda, I can say. But since the end of last year, and that seems to be reinforced in the last couple of months, we see in the Ukrainian media more and more articles that explain very bluntly that Ukraine is losing more ground. So there is absolutely no sign, I mean, for the readers, the Ukrainian readers, there's no sign of victory in all that. So therefore, what are we talking about? The weapons that recently, you may remember that at the end of last year, European Union promised to provide 1 million 155 millimeter shells to Ukraine. And they never managed to do so. There are just a couple of 100,000 that, in fact, made their way to Ukraine. But in addition to that, even in the Ukrainian media, you had reports saying that these, that was German media, sorry. The media I have in mind is German media. But even in German media, it was reported that this ammunition didn't work. It was so poor quality because they had to find those shells everywhere in the world, including in countries that didn't pay so much attention for the storage condition and all that. So this is outdated ammunition that is malfunctioning and all that. And they come to Ukraine. And remember that we had already last year that Ukraine had to refuse Leopard tank provided by Germany and Netherlands because these tanks were barely functional. So we see that the help we provide to Ukraine is becoming more inadequate because it's in terms of quality, in terms of generation, because this is mostly old generation armament. This equipment is not it doesn't provide any advantage for Ukraine. It's just there. Well, that you can use a tank as a pillow box, but you cannot use that as a tank, especially against T-90, the Russian T-90s, T-90s-M, and so on. So as a result, the Ukrainians themselves understand that the Western help reached a limit in quantity and in quality. So they don't see where they are heading to. And I think this recent trip to the US, in fact, just underlines the weakness of the West in fulfilling its promise. Because remember that in March, April 2022, Zelensky had almost reached an agreement with the Russians, whereby the Russians would withdraw from Ukraine in exchange of some kind of neutrality of Ukraine. But Zelensky exchanged this agreement against a support for as long as it takes. For as long as it takes. And today, Joe Biden said, that was in December last year, he said, we will provide a support for as long as we can. No longer as long as it takes, because the West is exhausted. The problem is that the promises we have given to Ukraine in 2022 were based on the assumption that Russia was weak, and with the sanctions, the Ukraine will be able to defeat Russia within weeks. And everybody was expecting Russia to crumble and to collapse due to the sanctions, because its economy would not be able to sustain the war and would not even be able to sustain the absence of trade with the rest of the world. But this didn't happen because Russia was prepared for some kind of, I would say, autarcy in a very broad sense. But in addition to that, the Russians managed to keep some ties with other countries, India, China, and the rest of the world, so that the absence of trade with the West was very quickly compensated by enhanced trade activity with the rest of the world. In addition to that, the West underestimated very significantly the inability of Russian economy to be able to sustain, sanctions. And that's for that underestimation, in fact, we deceived ourselves. We deceived ourselves with that. I remind you that in March 2019, this document produced by the RAND Corporation on extending Russia and outlining, in fact, the strategy that was applied to Russia in February 2022, this strategy, the RAND Corporation, those analysts of the RAND Corporation cautioned the West, saying, be careful, because probably a lot of assumptions we are basing this strategy on are probably underestimations of the real capabilities of Russia. And at the end of the day, Ukraine will suffer from this strategy more than Russia. And probably Russia will be able to resist much better than anticipated in this particular strategy. So even the analysts of the RAND Corporation acknowledged 3 years before the conflict that their strategy was probably doomed to fail because of the underestimation of Russian capabilities. And that's exactly what we are witnessing today. So there is no real surprise. The only problem is the inability of the political leadership in the West, and probably more in Europe than in the US, but this inability of touching base with reality, if you want. We are not able to see the reality. And as a result, we are still deciding in a world of fantasy. Literally, we fantasized on the capabilities of Russia. And I think that's the reason why Zelensky today must be very worried. And probably as suggested some, it must be worried not just for the fate of Ukraine, but probably must be worried about his own security. Because at the end of the day, if he has no alternative than negotiating, it might be some forces within Ukraine that don't want to allow that. I don't know. But this is what some suspect.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always, talking to you.
That was my pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you.